You're listening to the MoneyWeb Now podcast series with Simon Brown. Live streamed every weekday at 6:30 a.m.
Thursday, 2nd of July. We've got US jobs data out 2:30 our time. I'm Simon Brown, coming at you live and loud from the MoneyWeb Global Headquarters in Johannesburg, South Africa. On the show today, Kenyon Yana from Prime XBT. We've got South 32 selling the Richards Bay aluminium smelter to Alcoa, $5.6 billion. And then a quick look back at the first half of the year. JSE and gold under pressure, the US and South Korea, and oil to a degree, the green ones. Although oil's perhaps back, it had doubled at one point, back down to only 70. David Crozer from PPS, a rethink on equity-heavy portfolios. And then Liberty talking around their research on the messy middle, those mid-careers, 35 to 55. This podcast is brought to you by Stanlib Asset Management. Invest in more global opportunities through their partnership with JP Morgan Asset Management. Morning headlines, MoneyWeb process slashes valuation of AI hit subsidiary by more than half. Stack Overflow impaired by another 6 billion rand. Business Day, Pick and Pay boss forfeits multi-million rand incentive after slow turnaround. Retailer says Sean Summers fixed term contract has been extended to May 2028. Morning markets, US was red, S&P 0.2% down, Nasdaq 1.5% off. The East is mostly green, Sydney is up 0.3%, Tokyo is the red, down 1.25%, Hong Kong up 0.8%, Tencent 1.7% higher. Commodities mostly green, gold futures 4,077, Brent is the red at 70.64, platinum 1,624, palladium 1,233. The rand is 16.38, Bitcoin 60,500. Top 40 opening call, green open 125 points. 0.1% higher.
MoneyWeb Now on the money. Also available on podcast.
Chatting now with Ken and Yana, Prime XBT. Kia, always appreciate the early morning. That's it in the intro. South 32 selling that Richards Bay smelter to Alcoa for what, $5.6 billion, almost 100 billion rand. A big deal in a couple of senses. I mean, big for South 32, giant amount of cash for them, and big for the more broader country as Alcoa taking a significant stake in our sort of biggest aluminium smelter in the market.
I think so. I think it's. I find it quite a double-edged sword because over the weekend, Si, I was reading a report by an independent economic and energy analyst, Sepo Khadima, and what he's saying is that for the first time in a long time, South Africa has an excess spare capacity of energy of about 4,400 megawatts, of which it's because of the fact that a lot of energy-intensive industries such as ferrochrome smelters, aluminium smelters are being sold off. And for me, this is also an indictment on energy costs because I think South 32's corporate rationalization for this move is that South African energy costs are very high. This is not one of our core assets or assets of the future. Let's sell it off. But overall, a good deal for South 32 as they get a free cash upfront, about 3.1 billion and 1 billion in Alcoa shares. And then there's some commodity link contingent cash that may be available in the deal in the future.
Yeah, and I take a point. I mean, we suddenly find ourselves with far too much power and not quite sure what to do with it. I want to change tack and look back at sort of the first half of the year in terms of returns. Perhaps, I mean, it is weird because the two big winners last year was our local market and gold. They're both around 6% down. The US kind of doing what it does. Nasdaq's up 18%, S&P up just over 9%, this all in dollars. It kind of feels like every other year apart from last.
Yeah, I think so too. I mean, as you said, the under pressure assets are our local bourse, and I think it's facing persistent headwinds through the first half. I think domestically, the combination of higher interest rates, of which the SARB has been adding to that, also real take-home pay actually hitting a multi-year low, I think it's capped the retail and consumer-facing stocks because I think that's most of where the pressure is alongside gold, because I think the gold is operatingly leveraged towards the gold price, of which you can do nothing about but just take whatever price you get. But I think, as you said, the winners continue to be the U.S. equities. The U.S. equities, I think, even if you look in Southeast Asia, South Korea, I mean, up until last week, Thursday, of the big deleveraging AI stock ETF in South Korea, I mean, they were sitting at multi-year highs. I mean, I always tell my team, I'm like, look at the Kospi every morning, or look at the Nikkei. The amount of swings, the average true range of that stock market is ridiculous on a day-to-day price. But I also think the fact that oil prices and energy prices are coming back down, that's one of the winners, because that was the big structural macro headwind for the rest of the market.
Yeah, I mean, oil at one point was up 100%. It's now only, 17% up. You mentioned South Korea. I mean, it is off the highs, but I mean, and well off the highs. In dollars, it's up 90% for the year. And the flip side of it is Bitcoin is down 31% year to date. Either of those interesting to you, or are these just something which, I mean, I watch them, but I'm not out there buying either of them.
Yeah, I think with Bitcoin, I mean, since the 10th of October, there have been three resurgence in order to come back to the ceiling that Bitcoin has been. And every single time there's some capitulation in that momentum. And I think as recently as about 30th of March, there's been a decoupling from all other risk. There was a decoupling from other risk assets, but right now, since the beginning of June, there's a recoupling, meaning that whenever the AI trade happens and is quite persistently strong, Bitcoin is really strong. But I think right now there's just not much institutional conviction. And if you look at big buyers of treasury of Bitcoin, like MicroStrategy, actually selling some of their Bitcoin, I think it's also not boding well, because you need institutional participation in Bitcoin before you see retail legs.
Yeah. And to your point, I mean, MicroStrategy would have been a big part of the upward journey. But we'll leave it there. Kenyon Yona, Prime XPT, always appreciate the early morning. And that's our poll today on LinkedIn. Has your portfolio done first half of the year? It's been a mixed bag. It does depend where you were invested. It was certainly a volatile 6 months. Have your vote. Have your say. LinkedIn. Let your money benefit from experience with StanLib Asset Management. Find out about StanLib Global Select Fund, which follows an investment discipline that has delivered results for 3 decades.
MoneyWeb now, on the money.
I'm chatting with David Crozier. He is Chief Investment Officer, PPS Investments. David, appreciate the time. A recent piece that you put out, fascinating reading. You describe yourself as a purist in that you've kind of really spent your career focusing on that concept of inflation beating returns mean lots and lots of equities, and the numbers stack up, and it's been largely the right space to be. But you're conceding that post-retirement investing is perhaps forcing a rethink around that.
Yes, exactly. And I kind of use the analogy of driving, where I grew up with station wagons and felt station wagons were the way to go. And we all just need to, you know, suck it up. And obviously the car industry's had to evolve as people's tastes have changed, and they've realized that not everybody wants to sit in a station wagon and drive an SUV. And those solutions have obviously become more and more sophisticated. And now an SUV drives almost just as well as a station wagon. And I think similarly with the industry, we've kind of always felt, you know, you just need to take on this equity market risk and just suck it up. And if you don't like the short-term volatility, well, it's in your best long-term interest to hold equities. And dear Mr. Client, you just need to live with that. A bit like when my dad told me to have cold showers. And actually, you know, as the baby boomers have, I suppose, reached retirement, and as investors start to decumulate assets, you know, that view is increasingly being challenged, that, you know, the equity market, the volatility of equity markets is quite challenging. Yeah. And even for investors in pre-retirement who find the equity volatility uncomfortable, you know, the industry is increasingly trying to think of ways to not have to force people to go through that kind of short-term volatility with equity. So I think this is a very live thing that the industry is trying to solve. Mm-hmm. We probably haven't gone as far as the car industry with getting an SUV that drives as well as the car. I mean, the car industry has been dealing with that for 20, 30 years, but certainly increasingly, we're coming out with solutions that are trying to meet that requirement of still giving equity-based returns, or quite as close to that, but not with the sort of short-term volatility you get from equity markets.
And I get your point. And this is not to say, I mean, equities do the heavy lifting, and equities can work in retirement. And we're not saying that something's going to break the performance that we've seen from it. And the line that comes from it is, how is that return experienced? It's that, you know, I remember the question I would be often asked back in the day when buying, you know, how would you feel if it went down 40%? And the honest answer is, I'm not sure, but at the time, I'm probably going to dislike it intensely. It's that relationship, the experiencing of the return, which really is what matters.
Yes, particularly in, for example, in post-retirement, yeah, where you're drawing an income. So it actually becomes a real binding constraint. We've always, as an industry, been able to say in pre-retirement, well, if it's down 40%, you know, you're just buying it cheaper next month, yeah, in your monthly contribution. Mm. So do you really need to worry that it's down 40%? But in post-retirement, it's actually can be very significant if you're also trying to draw an income. And I think the main point I'm trying to frame is we just need to think about the problem differently. So when I said for most of my career, I've been a purist, I've really felt, what is the risk of not holding enough equities, and really thought around solutions that need to do that. But if you shift that to, you know, the downside is really significant, you start to think differently. You know, what is the risk of falling 40%, or what is the risk of underperforming cash?
Yeah.
And if you start to think like that from the sort of first principles, you have a great ability to try to construct things that look differently. Now, one of the big challenges we have is our industry is very much framed in the equities is good for you kind of framing. Mm-hmm. I mean, most of our unit trust categories are framed like that. And round the braai, everyone looks at how did the peers do and how did the equity market do. So the big challenge I think we have is trying to frame the problem differently. So if you're trying not to have significant drawdowns and you're trying not to underperform cash, then round the braai, you shouldn't be comparing your portfolio to one that is taking on a lot of equity market risk, yeah, and could be performing really strongly. And this is sort of the biggest challenge I think we probably have, is that investors, or all of us, want our cake and want to eat it. But we actually have to be quite explicit about what's really important for us and how do we want to build portfolios that really deliver on what's important. So in a station wagon, what are you wanting? In, yeah, an SUV, what are you wanting? And then intentionally construct portfolios to deal with that, rather than trying to do everything for everyone, which is just a recipe for disaster.
That's a great point, because my next point was going to be exactly around that, which is it's important to understand what we're buying, what we're getting, what are we trying to fulfill? And these are the age-old questions, but I suppose, to your point, go back to those first principles, go back to those first simple questions and work it from there.
Exactly. I mean, we as a multi-manager, we can also make this error. You know, if we want a manager to protect on the downside and to outperform cash, in a market where SA equities have gone up 40% like last year, one shouldn't necessarily be too critical that they might have underperformed a peer group that was willing to take on the risk of a drawdown but performed much strongly, right? Mm-hmm. Similarly, if we are not that worried about the short-term volatility and want to participate on the upside from equities, we could be critical of a manager that hasn't taken on enough risk.
Yeah.
But we need to be quite explicit about what we're looking for from the manager or the portfolio, and then basically back the portfolio to deliver that. I think that's a very useful evolution of where we go as an industry. And the more we figure out how to solve for post-retirement, and the more we explicit about what we're trying to achieve with our mm-hmm, clients. Mm-hmm. I mean, COFI is also helping us get there as an industry, where the regulators is asking us to be very explicit around the target market and what we're building for the client and how these are meeting clients' needs. So I think we're in an exciting place, both from where a lot of the assets in the industry is going towards post-retirement, as well as where the regulation's going, as well as the kind of technology or ways we can think about, yeah, about the market can help us solve.
Yeah, I take your point. Absolutely. It's evolving, but at this point, perhaps it's a faster evolve than we typically do see. We'll leave it there. It's Ever Crozies, Chief Investment Officer, PPS Investments. Appreciate the time. The Standard Flexible Income Fund is designed for pre- and post-retirement income and capital preservation needs. Retire without regret with Stanlib Asset Management.
MoneyWeb now. On the money.
Chatting with John Taylor, he's lead specialist investment product at Liberty. A new research from Liberty and the University of Cape Town, Liberty Institute of Strategic Marketing. The messy middle, a focus on mid-careers, 35 to 55. John, appreciate the time. A lot of fascinating data that comes out of this recent research report that you guys have done. One of them perhaps is what your research has termed peak vulnerability. This really is, I mean, it's when things are going well, but if things go wrong, particularly later in the bracket, you haven't got that time because you're close to retirement. If I mess up in my 20s, I've got 40 years.
Not so much if I'm 55.
This is it. I mean, we talk about peak adulting and kind of peak work as well. So this is talking to people that have, you know, they're not brand new in the working world, but they're also in that kind of phase where there's growing responsibilities, growing liabilities, and often cases they are sandwiched in between caring for their parents and caring for their children at the same time.
It is that sandwich generation which kind of makes it perhaps tougher. Also, folks are perhaps having kids later in life. You mentioned parents, they're living longer. It can add significant burden.
Yeah. I mean, part of the research that we picked up was that nearly half, 47% of people in their 30s and 40s are supporting both parents and children.
It is a scary number. They also, I mean, there's an admission. They admit to living beyond their means at times. And this is not necessarily because we're, you know, living it up in, you know, holidays in Mauritius. This is just because it is tough out there. Notwithstanding, you've got kids and parents that you've got responsibilities for.
Correct. And you can see that come through in the fact that we're seeing 42% of people in this kind of messy middle, people in their 30s and 40s, mm-hmm. you say that they are highly stressed about their financial situation.
And to that as well, they talk around, despite being in established careers, they're worried about job security. Gone are the days. I mean, my grandfather literally, in fact, both of my grandfathers started a job and worked it their entire life. That doesn't happen, and it happens even less. And I'm thinking, in the world of AI, there's even more to worry about, perhaps.
Yeah. So we've moved into a world where moving between jobs has become increasingly common. I mean, that's been a trend for quite some time. Mm-hmm. But it also then leads into this question around what the world of work looks like in an AI world and what that means for that trend in particular. And in particular, as we get closer to our retirement years, the fact that retirement isn't a one-day event anymore where you go to work for 5 days a week for 40 years and now all of a sudden you don't. There's mm-hmm. significant nuances to how that process happens.
That's actually a fair point because, you know, some of it is side hustle because, well, you can only play so much golf and sit on your porch so long. Some of it is, again, just good old-fashioned financial stress, which changes that notion and process of retirement.
Correct. And part of the research sets it out and calls it's not golden years, it's actually golden fears, where there's growing concern around financial security and personal purpose as people reach those retirement years.
Yeah, that's something that really stood out for me. What people from the survey, what people increasingly want is not excess, but security. And I would add to it, it's security of health as well.
Correct. And that kind of links back to that peak adulting kind of discussion where there's a genuine concern around slipping backwards. Part of what the respondents were telling our research colleagues working at the University of Cape Town was particularly around a concern, you know, I've progressed further than the generation before me, but it feels temporary because just one bad event like a retrenchment, an illness, a divorce, a bad year will set me back beyond where I started, you know.
That's actually a great point because it is. I mean, everyone, what we all want is better than the generation before us and we want the following on generations to do better. And to the point, I mean, the salaries are chunky, almost 380,000 for the 35 to 44, 470 for the 45 to 54. On paper, these are big numbers, but as you said, in reality, they're edgy. And it comes back to the key point. We've said it already. It's tough, you know, managing out there, I was going to say, in our economy, probably globally.
Correct. And it isn't. I think a lot of this translates quite well globally. And we spoke about that sandwich generation and the fact that we're caring for our parents at the same time as children. Let's also not forget that the age at which children are becoming financially independent is also getting later and later. And it's a massive concern, particularly to those in their 40s and 50s, that their nearly adult and in some cases very much adult children are still financially dependent on them, living at home, continuing to study, in some cases simply, you know, continuing to live at home with no necessarily financial benefits. So it's really difficult. And we know that's a global problem. That's not just in South Africa.
Yeah. And you add the report. You make a really great point. You know, we're not here to lecture people. That's not the process.
Correct.
But it is really a sense of, and this is more your responsibility perhaps than mine, but it's around products, models, advice, communications that become so much more important as circumstances change. For example, that generation gets squeezed by kids staying at home and parents living so much longer.
Correct. I think, Simon, I mean, in my particular industry, I think we've been rightly accused of lecturing and, you know, wagging a finger and saying we should have started earlier. for me, it's about changing that narrative around and saying, well, now it's never too early. It's actually that it's never too late as well. So how do we get people on track now so that they can build their something, given that this concept of retirement isn't a fixed line in the sand? Yeah. And for a lot of people, if you can start building that nest egg at any point in time, it just will reduce how much longer you have to work beyond where you would have hoped to retire.
Yeah, and that's a good point. It's also partly redefining that retirement as a concept, but we'll leave that for another conversation. It's John Taylor, he's lead specialist investment product, Liberty. Appreciate the time.
That's it for today. We were chatting with Arun Naidu yesterday, here, of course, from 91, talking around the new Fed chair and what, if anything, we learned from that first FOMC press conference. I really thought Kevin Warsh wasn't going to take any questions. He did, not many, but we asked you what you thought of him. Over half said too early to say, quarter saying he'll be fine. The rest said he seems very hawkish. Have your vote, have your say, LinkedIn. This podcast is brought to you by StanLib Asset Management. Invest in more certainty to navigate volatile market conditions. We're live every weekday morning. The MoneyWare website and the app, 6:30 a.m. podcast just after 7. Thanks to my team, Eddie Nobokli, Nicole Sabu, to you for listening, my guests for their time. My name is Simon Brown. This is MoneyWare Now. We'll chat again tomorrow. World Gold Council.
You've been listening to another MoneyWeb Now podcast, posted every weekday at 7 a.m. on moneyweb.co.za. MoneyWeb Now, on the money.